summers I've been right by your side since 2005. Hold up.
Hey y'all, we are back with another episode of Bed Talks. We are excited to have our guest on tonight. He is known as Matt Pfeiffer on Instagram, and he gives really great advice about not coaching, but relationships and dating. And I think what I've liked, Matt, is that you keep it real. You're giving that male perspective, and you're calling out things a lot of times that people don't talk about on the male side. So we appreciate that knowledge. But welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And notice we didn't say Fife, so I don't want people thinking, Tribe Called Quest, Pfeiffer. All right, just wanted to clarify.
Yeah, people, growing up, because I grew up in the 90s, so people, that was a nickname.
That would have been a great surprise, like if he would have busted out in a rap,
Just a freestyle.
I have a lot of talents, but that's not one of them.
Why don't you tell a little bit about yourself, about your background, and kind of how you came into this realm of, helping people in their relationships?
So I'm a therapist, coach, author. I wrote a book called Are We Allowed to Swear Here?
Well, we try to keep it family, but if it's something relating to material, give the label, give the name.
So the name of the book is Oh Shit, I Think They're a Fucking Narcissist is the name of the book.
Okay.
So that's the reason why I asked. And so that's my book. But how I got into dealing with relationships is when I have my first gig out of school, when I finished my degree in clinical mental health counseling, was in substance use therapy. And what happened is that I was actually avoiding getting into substance use. A lot of people, I just didn't think it was going to be a great fit, and it actually ended up being a very good fit. And what happened is I've always wanted to work with relationships, and I didn't realize how much I was actually going to learn about relationships, in particular toxic relationships, when I was dealing with that. So it was like drinking water from a fire hose, because what a lot of people find out when they work with me is that when you're dealing with toxic relationships, it's the same part of the brain that deals with addiction. Mm-hmm. And so I learned a lot. And then you're also dealing with, obviously, people who are in relationships and dealing with their own chaos and their own drama. I obviously have been through my own situations as well. Then when I left traditional therapy, I became more of a traditional dating coach, like you see every day on social media. And I was invited to be a guest speaker on, some of you might be familiar with Fly Newbie and Queen online. They're on Facebook and on YouTube as well. And they invited me specifically to talk about toxic relationships 1 week. And all of this was knowledge that I had acquired, but I didn't really realize that a lot of people actually needed it. And that video went viral, so they invited me back the following week, and I decided to kind of make it a thing, and here we are several years later.
Wow. I like what you said about how toxic relationships could be similar to addiction. I don't think we call that out a lot, and there was something I was looking at within your content that I wanted to ask you about that, because you talk about the common reasons that people struggle with healing from a toxic relationship. And if you think about addiction issues, the reason it's a struggle is because that it's just normal to keep going towards a certain habit. Mm. It's hard to break a pattern. Sometimes there's just not an awareness around it. But can you delve a little deeper into kind of what you learned about why toxic relationships are addictive?
They're addictive because for several reasons. Number one, it starts out in childhood. When I meet with people, I tell people that the person that they left, because oftentimes they leave and they're like, I know this person was abusive. I shouldn't be with this person. But when they leave, it's called a trauma bond, but that trauma bond, they miss them in an unhealthy way, almost like they're obsessed with this person. They can't sleep at night. Oftentimes they might go through sweat spells. And what that is it's actually withdrawal, the same way that someone who's suffering from a heroin addiction would go through withdrawal. And so it starts out in childhood, and what happens is that you're so used to catering to maybe a problematic parent, maybe an alcoholic parent, maybe you grew up in a domestic violent home or you had a narcissistic parent, something along those lines. But long story short, there's a quality about your family that has made you drawn to and feel comfortable in chaos. And not only comfortable in chaos, but uncomfortable in peace. And so when you meet people, and you hear people say this all the time, that we don't have, quote unquote, chemistry, not realizing that chemistry is a red flag, not a green flag. So they're so drawn to someone that they don't even realize that it's reminding them of someone in their past, that they really should be hesitant of connecting to this person, because they're so drawn to that chemistry and the love bombing and what's happening during that process. And the reason why the chemistry is a red flag, not a green one, is that you're literally becoming addicted, slowly but surely. And what happens is that you now put this person on a pedestal. You think this is the greatest guy, the greatest woman that you've ever met in your life, that they can't do anything wrong. Oh my goodness, the sex is so great, this and that. And you think this person is just absolutely amazing until something happens. Then all of a sudden, when the first time that they have road rage, they scream at you, they hit you. But because you have that person on a pedestal, the same way that someone who struggles with heroin addiction, I'm going to talk about heroin addiction briefly. The very first time that someone who struggles with heroin, whenever they use, the very first time that they use, they call it the most euphoric feeling that they've ever mm-hmm. felt in their life. Mm-hmm. And when you think about people who, when they first meet someone and they're like, I think I found my soulmate, and I think I found this, and it's literally the same exact thing. And so what happens is that once that relationship starts to decline, instead of you actually placing blame and responsibility for their bad behavior, you think that there's something wrong with you. And so what happens is that instead of you saying like, hey, don't treat me this way, don't do this, you try to fix it because you think there's no possible way that someone that this perfect could be this bad. And you hear people say this at the end of a relationship like this as well. They'll say things like, I still see good in them. I can't believe that they're like this. And it just doesn't fathom that. And it's all the same thing. All.
And you're talking about in extreme cases, correct? Because
not necessarily.
Okay, so please clarify, because I know, and I like, it threw me off a little bit when you said that, you know, chemistry, it actually puts up a red flag, and then you gave the reasonings as to why it puts up a red flag, and that makes a lot of sense. But on the flip side, so is chemistry a bad thing then, if you feel, you know, cohesive with someone?
So there's a big difference between chemistry and compatibility. What we're looking for is compatibility. Compatibility is something that matures and grows over time. So we do want compatibility. And, you know, to your point, we don't want chemistry at like a level 10. We want chemistry at like a level 6 or 7. Like, yeah, I like this person, but I don't feel like you're not in a situation where, especially early on is what I'm talking about, where I feel like I can't live without them. That's where we start to get very problematic, where, you know, within the first couple of dates, within the first couple of weeks and months, where someone's like, I feel like I found my soulmate. They can't, you know, they start to let go of a lot of things that they already have in life. You start to kind of notice that their work starts to decline. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, even if they're a single parent, they start to not spend as much quality time with their kids, things that are very important to them, same way that someone is dealing with a real actual addiction. If you're able to, and of course, everyone's going to be excited when you very first meet someone. That's true. That's true of everybody. But when you're allowing for that relationship to build naturally and slowly over time, you're able to still maintain a healthy relationship with and a healthy balance with the rest of your life. You know, without feeling like this, like I'm going to lose this person if I don't give up everything else.
And I'm gonna be honest with you. You know. Yes, there have been individuals where you may have met, I don't know, for the first time, and maybe you guys went on a few dates, two or three, several, and, you know, whether that was over a span of 2 or 3 weeks or 2 or 3 months, and you start to see the attachment. Now, a lot of people will be flattered by that in the initial state. Oh, man, he's all over me. He's pressuring me to go with him to Cancun. And Elizabeth talked about this with some people that she knows. And yes, I hear what you're saying. That can be a red flag, because you're already talking about chemistry when in actuality, the compatibility, you hadn't even given it enough time to determine if you are compatible.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You don't even really actually truly know that person. Mm-hmm. You're still not only in the honeymoon phase, but you're still so early on that you don't even know if you can trust this person to to go to Cancun or to go. And oftentimes when you talk to people, once the relationship starts to end, they'll tell you and they'll open up about how problematic a lot of those trips are whenever they go too quickly. And am I saying not to enjoy trips and road trips and things like that? No, but I am encouraging people to slow down, because oftentimes those are the things that people are getting attached to. They're getting attached to this dream and this pedestal and this vision of what this person possibly could be. And what happens is that, and one of the things I work with people after the relationship is over, is that we'll actually go back to the beginning stages during this whole chemistry thing, and not in a way of victim blaming, but in a way of victim empowering. I ask them, and everyone always is able to pinpoint a moment. There was something, as great as everything was, there's always something that something internally said, you need to walk away from this, and you didn't listen to yourself. And oftentimes they it's always something they didn't tell anyone. They just assumed that this person was not going to do that again because they had this person on a pedestal. It could have been a slap. It could have been they found out this person was still with somebody else. It could have been road rage. It could have been, but something says like, this is awful. You need to get away from this person. But because of the Cancun trips and because of the love bombing, because the whining and dining, and because of all that, they just assume that they still see the good in them. They just assume that they can work things out to get it.
Which in actuality are addictions when you think about it. Not in a bad way. I mean, who doesn't want to go on some, you know, excursion to Europe or to be wined and dined? So I'm starting to see the correlation now with those examples you're giving.
And what I was going to say is, I think the theme you're saying is anything in extreme measures, anything that disrupts, sudden or
extreme highs and extreme lows,
right? And that's disruptive to like what you're doing on a regular basis, where you feel like you have to maintain it. Because there's, I mean, I think a lot of us have been there in relationships where we're like, oh, this person's so great, to your point, because maybe they came so strong and it was just like overwhelming. Mm-hmm. But then in looking back after you're out of it, you're like, wait, I was putting in so much, losing so much. But you cannot see it in the moment because the emotions are almost crippling, which the brain does something. I mean, there's dopamine, you know, oxytocin hits. I mean, there's a chemical response that's happening in us that makes it easy, you know, hard to detach or see it really for what it is. But
You try to stop people from, it sounds like you really try to coach people to take, just slow down just a little bit. Just, you know, see everything for what it's worth first. I know Elizabeth does the same similar thing, you know, when something sounds almost too good to be true. You know, you just met her or you just met him. And so I'm hearing that, you know, amongst both of you with your professions.
Yeah, because what people have to realize is that everybody has red flags. Everybody does. And so
say that again for everyone to hear.
Repeat.
Everybody has red flags. All three of us on that, everyone who's listening has red flags. So when people get into a situation and I start hearing things like, this person has no red flags, and you just hear them on a pedestal, this person is my soulmate, and it's only been, you know, a couple of weeks or maybe a couple of months. It's typically, you know, there's an issue. And what I tell people is that if there are no red flags, you either A, don't know this person very well, or B, you're moving too quickly and you're not seeing what the real actual red flags, or you're flat out just in denial about what they actually are.
Throw in the sea. I thought she was going to throw in the sea. You know, they're hiding something. You know, but no.
It could be hiding something too. Yeah. So when you slow down, what happens is that you're actually able to see this person for who they actually are. And you're able to determine, you know, are these red flags that I do see, are they deal breakers, or are they something that's more negotiable?
Yeah, I think the challenge now is like everyone is learning the terminology, which is amazing. But I'm sure this like gets to you like it gets to me. But sometimes the terminology gets misused or misunderstood. So like one thing I wanted to talk to you about is narcissism, because like narcissism is a term that people have learned of as of late, you know, the last, I'd say 3-4 years, that you hear it more and more pronounced. And sometimes I think people misunderstand or misuse the terminology. So I noticed that you do a lot around narcissistic abusive cycles. So can you break down for our listeners, like, what that looks like, you know, to be with someone that's a narcissist?
And also as a parent, too, if you don't mind, because you made that, you mentioned that earlier, and I didn't get a chance to ask you, what is a narcissistic parent? So like Elizabeth is asking on the dating end, I'm curious on both ends.
Yeah. So when we're talking about someone who's narcissistic, we're now crossing over from what would be problematic toxic behavior to someone who is also controlling and abusive, makes everything all about them. And the reason why I'm actually, you're going to notice that there's going to be a change in my content because of what you mentioned, it becoming more problematic. I'm going to be not talking as much about narcissism for multiple reasons, which I'll get into here in a second. But a narcissist has this need to control all aspects of the other person. They think of you, they don't think of you as an, I know when I mentioned control, a lot of people go, I like control too. But this is to a point where when they don't get their way, they have the ability to become abusive, whether it be psychological, mental, and they want to, or physical. And they want ultimate control. So going back to what we were just talking about of a relationship moving too quickly, a narcissist will intentionally get you pregnant or intentionally have a baby with you or buy a house. And all these things sound great on the surface. Mm-hmm. Until you're actually in the relationship, now you can't leave. Now this person who you thought was going to be able to take care of you financially or took over your finances if you were the one that was the breadwinner. Oftentimes people think that it's only the people who are the breadwinners and the stay-at-home moms who are the victim. It could be the other way around, where the stay-at-home mom is controlling all the finances because she's the one that is managing all the money. And then now they're now making threats that if you were to ever leave, if you're ever to do this, and it could be something over something simple. So what happens is that this causes, you know, going back to what we're talking about with the addiction, it causes a lot of PTSD and a lot of you feel like this person has ultimate control over you, over your life. You think these, and keep in mind, you've had this person on a pedestal because of those beginning stages. And so now what happens is that now there's a trauma bond that even though you know, you may not admit it, you may not tell your friends, you may not tell your family, you know that this relationship is problematic. You know it's controlling, you know it's abusive, but you also don't know what to do about it because a part of you thinks that the relationship can change back for the better, but you also internally know that this relationship ultimately is now chaotic and is now, you're now in a narcissistic abuse cycle.
And you know, you talked about this trauma bonding, which that happens probably more than what people think, right? But how do people break out of a trauma bonding situation? Because sometimes maybe they don't have the resources they feel, right? They're really stuck. They are in a situation where maybe that person's the breadwinner, they're controlling the finances, and they really have let their lives go in a way, right, to accommodate this relationship. How do you coach people like through or counsel them through how they can still kind of find their footing? Because I think sometimes people feel helpless. Like they know they're in a destitute situation. They can see that it's not a great situation, but they can't see their way out of it.
And it's a level of dependency, you know.
There is. So that was something I talk about a lot is the dependency that we have on this person. And, you know, because if one person is narcissistic, the likelihood is that the other person is codependent. It's called a codependent narcissistic dance. Oftentimes, and this is a lot of the reason, going back to what I was talking about, why I'm not talking about narcissism as much. I'm still going to provide the services. But the problem is that what you're starting to see on social media and online is that people are all pointing fingers at the narcissist, problematic and as abusive as they are.
There's people that enable.
We have to understand. Mm-hmm. That is, it's the narcissistic codependent dance. So there's also something wrong with the person who is the victim. And when I say something wrong, what I mean, I don't mean that they're bad or anything like that. What I mean is that we have to understand that there was something that gravitated you towards that. And there's something that about you that allowed for this person to take over so much control. And if that person doesn't also do the work, then this behavior is going to continue within other relationships. And so online, what you're seeing is that you have a lot of people that are just blaming narcissists. And typically the other problem that I'm seeing online is that a lot of people are assuming that it's only men who are narcissists, and that's not even close to being
true. It goes both ways,
Right, it goes both ways. And so you, so there's a lot of, to what you were talking about before, a lot of bad information that's
circulating
out there.
Yeah, I'm glad you wrote that down, because I do feel like, I think it's great that people are getting the knowledge, getting the help, empowering themselves, but I do think it's also important that the knowledge is the correct knowledge, right? So we're not perpetuating things that aren't, you know, completely true. So I like that you're calling out that men and women can be narcissists, because sometimes you do hear it more one way than the other.
To your point, I didn't even answer the question. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, go ahead.
But you have to, you absolutely have to, you can't heal the, you can't break the trauma bond while you're still in the relationship. Mm-hmm. You have to get out. So what I tell people is you're not getting out of the relationship unscathed. You're not, you know, this thought process that you think that the narcissist is going to be compliant or is going to be cordial, even if they tell you that they're going to be cordial, they're not. They're going to wipe the bank accounts clean. They're going to be extremely problematic, possibly physically abusive throughout the relationship and throughout even the breakup afterwards, because they start to realize that they're losing ultimate, and they're losing the control. But that, to truly break the trauma bond, once you're actually gone, you have to go no contact or low contact if you have children, therapy, coaching. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to understand.
You need a support team. You need a support team. I think people miss that a lot of times. Like, what makes people strong is sometimes having to lean to people outside of them that have expertise to guide you. And I like what you said. You're not going to come out unscathed. So there might be a sacrifice for a moment, right, of not having that financial dependency, but having to refigure that out. But I think staying in it, you just can't heal from it when you're in
it. Well, I mean, but let's kind of change channels a little bit, because what if you're dealing with someone, and I've known people who are big on faith, okay? And, you know, they see that they're with a narcissistic, you know, individual. They love him. They love her. They don't want to leave. You know, they want to honor their vows. And they, you know, they, you know, through faith, they believe, you know what, I'll just pray my way through this, or I'll get me a support, you know, support system of prayer warriors or something of that magnitude. How would you direct that person? Do you think the same applies to someone who either has faith or doesn't have faith? Because common sense is still common sense. And I've said that many a times, whether you are of the faith or whether you're not, common sense is still common sense. How would you address that?
Oftentimes people think that biblically that it doesn't support someone leaving a relationship like that. And I completely, completely disagree. So narcissism is actually all throughout the Bible. And there's plenty of examples of reasons why and how you should leave narcissistic relationships. Think about in the beginning when God had to deal with Satan. He knew that he wasn't gonna change. What'd he do? He had to kick him and all of his friends out of heaven. If God can't change a narcissist, if he couldn't put up with it, if he couldn't deal with it himself, what makes you think that you can? Mm-hmm. Right? So we have that example. We have the example of Jesus multiple different
times. Well, let me backtrack, because it's not you changing the person. No, I didn't say the person. I'm saying prayer, because, you know, I mean, prayer does change things. But what I am saying, like that example you gave with Satan, you're right. You know, of course, God gives everyone free choice, free will. If God wanted to robotically change Satan, he could have. But yeah, but in a relationship, I don't want you thinking I'm saying that that person can change the individual. No, I'm saying through faith, some people believe that they can still remain and pray their way through.
But that's what I'm saying, is that even with prayer, right, in certain circumstances, that if God thought that that prayer would have helped in that situation, and the second example I was actually going to give was Jesus dealing with the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Right. If prayer would have worked in those situations and circumstances, that would have been something that he would have talked about. But instead, he slipped through the crowd. And he also said multiple different times that when someone doesn't receive you well, to make sure you kick the dust off your feet. There's plenty of examples of the fact that some people, regardless of prayer or not. And also we also have to understand that in certain circumstances, And I'm not telling people not to pray. I'm not telling people not to exhaust. I'm not saying that leaving people or divorcing people or anything like that should be the first option. I actually think it should be the last option. So if you feel like you're at a point where you need to pray and things like that, but you also need to, it's also very important to be a good steward over your things, understanding that this person, because people are narcissistic, they're going to be wiping your bank account clean, they're going to be zapping you in it physically, mentally, and emotionally. It's also going to have dramatic impacts on your children if you share children, and it also literally is going to put you into an early grave. And I'm not just saying that, I literally mean that. Mm-hmm. Is that it's going to end your life a lot faster. And even if this person isn't physically abusive, the physical aspects of what the stress is going to do to you throughout the relationship is going to put you into an early grave. You start to notice that you begin to lose your hair. There's extreme weight gain, weight loss. There's a lot of different aspects to it. So we have to understand that even biblically, right, that there's support to understand, and there's situations and there's examples of times where people still needed to leave, and understand that that doesn't make you faithless. That actually makes you even more faithful to be a good steward of God.
And also, you were going to talk a little bit about the narcissistic.
Hold on. Okay. You missed nothing? That was an applause, sir.
You know, he saw it.
Okay,
he heard
that was an applause. Let me tell you why I put on. I know you probably couldn't hear it as clear. Probably sounded like waves or something on your ear, but that was actually an applause. Let me tell you why. You really hit some topics. Now, I can play, some people say devil's advocate, and sometimes, you know, I play along with the audience because these are questions that people have, and sometimes these are questions that I have. But you said some things that I have to agree with you. Not going into my history or my past, but there have been people, unfortunately, that I was linked to. Now, again, we've already discussed everyone had baggage. So I had my baggage, too, you know. But to see that narcissistic, and I didn't even know what the term was then. This was years ago. And to go through, and I'm sure there's a lot of people in the audience. Yes, there was someone who would show you their best side and then their worst side, sometimes within the matter of minutes, that mentally, spiritually, emotionally, it can affect your health and take you to an early grave. And so I had to give you that applause, because that was something I said to myself years ago. I said, I'm not going to an early grave. I have a daughter that I'm raising. I have a life I want to live. So I just had to give you that applause, because as you said, it should be your last resort. That's, you know, try to exhaust what you can, but don't exhaust your life if you can help it. So I just had to give you the applause for that, for Elizabeth just quickly jumped in. Now go ahead and proceed.
I'm really enjoying this conversation so much. You're, you know, these gems of wisdom that you're bringing to our audience and to us, like, these are really good things. I like the way you're talking through, you know, how people can think about their relationships a lot differently from, like, not just the, we always say this in the natural way, but in a spiritual way too. But I did want you to comment too on the narcissist parent. Like, what does that look like, you know, for kids out there that just might be struggling through their relationships with a narcissistic parent, and really they may feel like they don't have a way or a coping mechanism.
Which are still the same similar attributes.
It's similar, right. So you know, I'm guessing it's similar, but
it's not that much of a difference, you know.
It's not, because it's still the same.
Right.
It's still the same type of person. It's still the personality type. It's still all about them. And when you're dealing with a narcissistic parent, everyone's going to have their own experience. You're going to have the golden child. You're going to have a scapegoated child if there's multiple different children in the family. If you're the only child, there's going to be times where you feel like you are the golden child and you can't do anything wrong. And there's going to be times where you are the scapegoated child where you can't do anything right. There's also the invisible child. And so, long story short, it doesn't matter which child you are. Everyone, all the children, ultimately know that there's something wrong. A lot of times people think that the golden child has it good because they can't do anything wrong, but the golden child feels an immense amount of pressure because they have to be perfect all the time. Because what's happening is that they're actually fulfilling the narcissist is living their life through the golden child. So they are this image and the perfect representation of what the narcissist thinks that they themselves should be. And so any little slight mistake that they make, and when I say slight, it could be extremely slight. So let's say that they're living their basketball goals through you. And you God forbid you have a turnover, which is going to happen from game to from time to time, and then now you are mistreated. You might have the silent treatment. They're going to ostracize you for, you know, days, sometimes weeks or even months, depending on the situation. And so it becomes extremely problematic having a parent like this. And that's as a child, but as an adult, you start to realize as you get older that your parent is still attached to you in an unhealthy way. They might try to say, and they might try to claim as though this is, you know, that they just love you. But you will likely start to get some feedback and some pushback from your significant other, from your friends, that this person or your problematic parent is too involved. You start to notice that you can't be an individual. You can't make your own decisions about the things that you want to do, the way that you want to live your life, your career choices. And you start to also notice that even if you do make the quote-unquote right decision, meaning that you make the decision that they want, there's still nothing that you can do that is going to make them happy. So they want you to become a doctor, so you go to school to become a doctor. And then you don't go to you're going to school to become a doctor, but it's not like you're going to Duke or anything. So then you go to Duke, and then they say, yeah, but you had to transfer to Duke. And so you become a doctor, and they're like, yeah, but you're a pediatrician. It's not like you're a surgeon. So then you become a surgeon. Yeah, but you're, and it's just like, no matter what you do, that goalpost is always moved. And you find yourself always trying to please that parent. And you notice that they're never, ever, ever pleased.
Really, really helpful. Yes. And again, extremes, no balance. Is always, you know, a good indicator with relationships, with people's personalities, because I mean there should be some balance, right? There's a middle ground.
Absolutely.
Right.
Let's change lanes quickly before we end the show.
I got like two more questions. So
get your questions out.
You're gonna like the next one. This is for you. So we have noticed, like, in society, the terminology toxic masculinity is coming up a lot.
That was the one I was.
Proceed,
my love.
Okay. But at the same time, I do think there is a little bit of emasculization happening with males. So how do men protect their masculinity without it being misunderstood as toxic masculinity? Because there's a balance. I mean, women have...
That was way better than my version.
That was better than your version. Because I think women also are losing some of their femininity. Mm. And oftentimes it's being kind of tailored, you know, to thought, like, if you're expressing this way of being feminine, that you're not strong, that you can't express these things. So it's almost like there's a role shifting that's happening. And I saw that you had talked a little bit about this in your content. So I was curious, like, what your take on it is.
If we're talking about masculinity or femininity, yeah, it's toxic behavior, because really, all toxic behavior, even if we're talking about a narcissist, comes back down to deep, deep rooted insecurities. Mm. And so when people have insecurities, and when they don't have emotional intelligence, and they don't know how to handle their own or other people's big emotions, then what you're going to start to see is that you're going to start to see some toxic behavior of control, of lashing out, of really what it is childlike behavior. That's what it is. Because people are not being raised properly, people aren't being taught emotional regulation as children, and so you start to see people throwing adult tantrums. You start seeing people, you know, if you really actually look at it, you start to see, and you become emotionally intelligent, you start to realize that you basically have children in adult bodies in these type of situations, regardless if we're talking about from men or from women, and so. So for the men out there that are dealing with quote unquote toxic masculinity, what I would say is that become more emotionally intelligent, begin to get into therapy, begin to work on yourself. It is completely okay to be masculine and to also be emotionally intelligent, to know how to resolve conflict in an appropriate way, rather than, you know, doing it the way that maybe we've been taught growing up.
Mm-hmm. I know you have a follow up. Go for it.
It almost sounds like, and I'm just basing this off of some of my experiences, you know, being masculine, first of all, that's a natural innate trait that men have, just like women have a feminine trait. And but again, from my experiences, it's not that being masculine was toxic a lot of the times. It was just that society or your workspace or wherever it is that you conduct your business wanted to change, you know, change that whole atmosphere of being a man's man. I'm not talking about cussing people out. I'm not talking. Okay, for example, like you have some men who work in the educational system and public school systems. Yeah. And it just seems like now there's a transition that we don't want that type of masculine man. We kind of want the more sensitive, you know, understand. And I'm not saying that you're not masculine if you aren't sensitive. Right. I'm just saying remove the masculine piece altogether and just, you know, conform to this more, you know, feminine side of how you should instruct and engage with students, which I disagree with, you know, because you are taking a component of that, who that man is, and trying to, and vice versa, you know, for women in some cases as well, you know, you're taking the feminine side of the woman. Some have had to be, you know, some unfortunately have been forced to take on those roles. We know that. But when you've lost such a feminine side, you know, to the other persuasion or to the opposite sex, that can sometimes be a turnoff, and it can also be a red flag.
Well, the problem where it comes in is that what people have to understand is that everybody has both masculine and feminine qualities mm-hmm. to them. And so we have to understand that if we're going to take away masculinity completely, we have to understand that for every give, there's a take. So if we take away that component, there's a lot of women who have a masculine component to themselves who are going to also lose a sense of identity and a sense of belonging if we just remove that altogether. And we also have to understand that I always compare relationships to a baby mobile. When you start to pull and tug on one end of that baby mobile, it has an effect on all of the other toys on that baby mobile. If we take that part away, it's going to throw the balance off. And so now all of a sudden, if we have people who are behaving, I don't want to say behaving feminine because that sounds off, but what I mean is that when we have people who are, it's actually suppressing masculinity, because people aren't going to be able to just shut that off, right? They're not going to be able to shut off being competitive and that sort of thing. If we have people that are suppressing that and thinking that there's something, they're going to think there's something wrong with them, which is going to create insecurity, which now all of a sudden, instead of you thinking that you solved toxic masculinity, you just threw gas on the flame. You created more of it.
Interesting. God, I have so many questions for you. This is hard. Okay, but I know our time... I'm a nerd about this stuff. He knows this. I could talk about it all day.
I'm surprised.
I can tell you can too. But anyway, I'm trying to think of which one I want to talk to. Okay, so I'll go with the controversial one. So I like where you posted that men fake orgasms too, because I think there's this misnomer out there that, you know, men are physical beings. They are visual creatures. All of that is true, right, to some degree. But I think women sometimes overestimate the physical connection as being the connection that will lead to the connection. So I thought it was really cool that you called it out a bunch of times. You're like, no, this happens on both.
I might call it again today, later on today. So
you said what?
I said I might call it out again later on today. It's been fun.
Yeah, yeah. So tell our audience, I should say, a little bit about, you know, that topic, and about how, you know, there could be almost a, you know, a perception around it that's kind of missed when it comes to, like, you know, sexual connection between two people.
Men and women are a lot more alike than what people give them credit for. You know, especially like when you go online, when you go on social media, you know, you have this perceived war of the genders, and it's almost like there's a victim Olympics going on between the two genders, where like one, you know, both people are trying to see like who was victimized more by the other gender, when really we just need to sit down and we need to talk together, where there's more alike than what we are apart. And so that topic of men faking orgasms was inspired by someone who was actually making fun of men in the bedroom. And so they were making fun of men, and what happened was, as she was making fun of men, she was like, really, you know what? I'm going to give you guys more credit, because I actually tried y'all's moves and I got tired.
I saw that. She got tired. She's like, yeah. This is a lot of work.
Yeah, this is a lot of work. Like, I'm going to give you guys a little bit more credit. And then, so that's when I said, yeah, and that's why we fake orgasms. So I wanted to pull the genders onto, you know, again, together, right? That you know what? We do the same things that you do. We fake orgasms just like you do because we're tired. And what I haven't talked about, which I'll talk about later on in the videos, is that men will fake orgasms if we're distracted. There was people in my comment section saying, you know, well, we fake orgasms because we're women in the comment sections because, you know, we can't focus and this and that. Sometimes men do the same exact thing, mm-hmm. that they can't focus or maybe they just, you know, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they're not interested in the person. It doesn't even necessarily mean that they're not having a good time or the sex is bad or anything like that. Just sometimes they might struggle in that moment. Maybe and a lot of times people will say, well, they must be cheating. No, they could have taken care of themselves before because they didn't know that they weren't expecting anything to happen. There's a lot of reasons why men may fake orgasms, and so it was important for us to I think it's important for us to have these type of dialogues, have these type of deep, rich connections and deep, rich, raw conversations. Because we need to, if we're going to connect and if we're going to have healthy relationships, it's going to take this level of vulnerability.
Okay, hold on. You guys are sounding as if, are you all implying that it's the same percentage of men fake orgasms as the same percentage of women?
I'm not saying that it's okay. The same percentage.
Okay.
Because I think that the studies and the research show that it's about 27%. I will say that I believe that number is just like a lot of other numbers when it comes to men, is very underrepresented and very underreported.
Yeah, because I can see men holding back from admitting that because part of masculinity is expressing yourself sexually. Think about that. So there could be almost a fear, right, of being honest about it. Like, no, really, I'm not into it. Because it's expected that a man really would be, you know, more sexual than a woman.
And that's actually one of the reasons why a man will fake an orgasm, because they don't feel like they're performing. They don't feel like if they have an orgasm that they're not performing well in bed. And so,
And on the flip side, the woman won't feel like she has satisfied the man. So I think that's also a part, you know, or can be a part of it. You
right,
know,
it's an ego thing. On
yeah,
both
she's like,
sides,
I didn't please you, so you know, you fake it so you can hurry up and get gone. All right, last thing, man. You had a post, and I really enjoyed it. I don't know who the guy was, the gentleman that you had on, but it was a golf ball reference. And it was in lieu of, you know, when golf balls first came out, you know, there were no dimples in the golf balls. And they mistakenly found that if, you know, and when a golf ball was divoted or dimpled, it flew faster. It you know, it went longer. And I really liked that dialogue and what that gentleman was saying.
Yeah, that was Joe Buttner, for those of you who haven't looked for him. Joe Buttner, he's a great person to follow as well.
What was his name?
Joe Buttner.
Okay, Joe Buttner. Yeah. So I just thought that you know, that exchange and, you know, the comparisons.
Okay, you're leaving us all hanging. So what was the analogy?
That's why he's going to tell. Mr. Okay. Pfeiffer's going to tell the story.
So I won't be able to articulate the golf ball analogy as well as he did. But what he said was that when golf balls first came out, they were smooth. Mm-hmm. And what they found out is that and they found out because golf balls over time became damaged. Mm-hmm. And they found out that the more they had the dimples to them, the further that they went. So what he was talking about is the fact that, you know, when the things that happen to us, it doesn't change us and doesn't make us less worthy. It doesn't change our worth. It actually increases our worth. Mm-hmm. And I have a similar analogy, not the same one, but when we go through things like that, that wisdom that we gain from our experiences, that increases our self-worth. That should increase who we are. It doesn't increase our value. It doesn't decrease ourselves. And oftentimes when people go through a divorce and they go through a breakup or, you know, they lose a job, we think that somehow that makes us less of a man, less of a woman, or that we're more problematic, or we have baggage now, when it actually increases our value. If we take the wisdom and we now apply it and we look at it instead of looking at it as a mistake and look at it as an opportunity for growth.
Well, I love that because I agree that sometimes in those moments, your worth feels so low because of how we tie things to our relationships, mm-hmm. to our careers, to what we have achieved, right? But often it's when we are going through those moments, there are greatest learning moments. And yep. really, when we go through it again, we're like, oh, that happened for this reason to get me to this next step. And sometimes you just cannot see it in that moment. So I like that
analogy. In some cases, it's, you know, the evidence is physical, mm-hmm. you know, meaning someone may have gained weight, or I know Mr. Pfeiffer was talking earlier, maybe their hair may have fallen out. Mm-hmm. So even though, yes, it still shows their worth,
right.
mm-hmm. you know, just like, again, they would not have known what to do with the golf ball had they not already seen the damaged golf ball, mm-hmm. you know, and revamped it to where now, you know, that's, we see it in this most perfect form. So,
yeah,
absolutely.
Such a great conversation. We hope you'll come back again because this was
absolutely anytime.
This was awesome. Why don't you tell people a little bit about where they can find you, some of the work you're doing that you may want people to look out for as well?
So you can find me all over social media, Matt Pfeiffer Coaching. My main platform at the moment, I would say, is YouTube. I go live on YouTube pretty close to every single day. And my YouTube channel, if you look up Matt Pfeiffer Coaching or the channel, the name of the channel is The Matt Pfeiffer Experience, because that's where I host my podcast as well. But you can also listen to my podcast on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever it is that you listen to podcasts. One thing that I'm getting into that a lot of people don't realize is I'm getting more into helping people build their scale their business and build their brand and basically duplicate the success that I've found online. And so for people who may have a business and may have a service-based business, it's not just any of them that I work with, but a service-based business, that's something that I do as well. So branding and content strategy and that thing, those type of things as well.
So what do you do in your spare time? I'm kidding.
Well, I have a, you know, to your point, going back to something you said in the beginning about having a support system, you know, I have a great, great support system. So I have a lot of free time. I spend my time with my kids. You know, me and my son were at a restaurant last night watching the Bills play. And so we're a sports family, and my daughter plays soccer, watch her games, and you know, we're a sports family, so we like to be outside.
How old are your kids?
My son is 19, my daughter is 16.
Okay. Oh, wow. Okay. I mean, you guys have a great quarterback right now and a great team, so I'm hoping this year will be a little more exciting. I mean, last year was exciting, yeah. but a little disappointing at the end, but, you know. Yeah. I do watch the Bills too.
She's saying that now. As soon as we get off the air, I'm just playing.
He knows I get a little obsessed with players. I love football. So it's like I'm always like, wow. I mean, and Josh Allen is just amazing.
He's really good.
Yeah. Amazing.
He's the deal. He is the deal.
So on that note, we are gonna wrap up our show. You guys go check out Matt Pfeiffer. I mean, this guy has a lot of knowledge. We can tell that he's helping lots of people out there navigate their relationships. I'm also helping people build their businesses, and also a family man. So he's, you know, he's covering all bases. And we are so excited that you were able to come on tonight and just educate, you know, our audience. We're going to end the show on that note. You guys, you know, we appreciate you always subscribing and following us. And remember, you can always listen to our episodes of our podcast on the Anchor app, iTunes, Google, as well, and other platforms. And until next time, I'm going to sign off with Kay.
Good afternoon, good evening, good night, and good morning to you podcasters out there, since Elizabeth did not give me the opportunity at the beginning of the podcast. All Y'all
right.
be good.
All right, take care.
I'm not. I'm not. I'm not.